You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 97, covering the week of November 6th through November 10th, 2017. Glad to have you back on the program. Glad to be here. Before we get started, usual housekeeping material. If you do like this podcast, please share it around on social media. And of course, you can find the Abbeville Institute on social media. You can find us on Facebook at Abbeville Institute, on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, and on YouTube. You can subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville INST. If you don't want to go out and search for all those things, you can go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll find our social media buttons, and you can click on those and find all of our social media accounts. That way, you can also find our Amazon Smile account, which helps throw a few pennies our way when you shop at Amazon. You can make us our preferred, you can make the Abbeville Institute your preferred charity. And if you're on our webpage, you can give us an email address, and we will send you our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email address either Saturday or Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast along with a separate reading article, something a little extra for the week. Also, remember, we do exist on your generous contributions alone, so if you do want to help support our mission to explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition, please consider making a tax-deductible contribution to the Abbeville Institute. You can find all of that information on our webpage. Just go to abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, click on the support button. You'll see membership for individuals, and for as little as $3 a month or $25 a year as a student, you can help us support our mission, or $5 a month and $50 a year as a non-student. You can help us explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. And this is Charitable Contribution Month. So, November is that. They have such a thing. So you're going to be seeing a few emails from us trying to wrap up the year. If you're thinking about taxes for this year and wanting to save a little money on taxes and you want to throw a few pennies our way, we'd appreciate any support you can give us. We have all kinds of ideas, but without your support, most of those ideas cannot happen. So we need financial contributions from the loyal listeners and supporters of the Abbeville Institute. We also have programs coming up. We do have a program coming up in February of next year. We will have details on that within the next couple of weeks. So I believe it's the last weekend of February, so be thinking about that. And mark your calendars down. It's going to be a good event, and it will be in Charleston, South Carolina. So we'll be back in Charleston in February. Okay, let's talk about the material for this week, and it's an interesting, kind of an eclectic week. We've been doing this a lot recently. By the way, if you do have an article submission, send it my way. McClanahan at abbevilleinstitute.org is my email address, and you can shoot me an article, an idea, or shoot me an article you've written, and we'll take a look at it, and might see your name on the bright lights of the Abbeville Institute. But we do enjoy getting contributions from our listeners. So we had some interesting material this week. Two of the pieces focused on Reconstruction and the changing narrative of Reconstruction. And I think that's an interesting topic because it's something that we're in the sesquicentennial of Reconstruction now. Here we are, 2017. We had the first Reconstruction Act in 1867, so 150 years ago, and that began military Reconstruction. So we're starting to think about this time period of military Reconstruction just 150 years ago. And in the grand scheme of things, that's not a long period of time, really. I mean, there are people that are still alive, they're over 100 years old, so we're not that far removed from this period of Reconstruction. It seems like people, though, want to think it's this ancient history, and it's something that we need to get over, or Southerners need to get over Reconstruction, or maybe it was an unfinished revolution. We need to go back and actually complete it. And the only thing that would have been better for Reconstruction had the Grant administration and the Northerners actually executed all these Southerners and convicted them of treason and gone out there and decimated the South. Well, they already did decimate the South, but they didn't get their execution or treason wish. And that's because the majority of Americans didn't support that position. And this is very clear when you look at the historical record and why these things didn't happen, because Northern Americans didn't want them to happen. This whole notion nowadays that somehow reconciliation was the enemy of the war, I mean, that's ridiculous. But reconciliation was an effort to find peace after 4 years of war. People were tired of combat and tired of fighting each other, and they just wanted to get back to the Union and back to the way things were. Now, we had a different Union, of course, but they wanted to resume as quickly as possible. This was Lincoln's idea in Reconstruction. He wanted resumption rather than Reconstruction, which is why the radicals didn't like it. So that has to do a lot with interpretation. What's happened over time, and this is something I've said on my own podcast, is that we've gotten the radical northern version of the war foisted upon us on a daily basis in our modern education institutions, in our journals and other things. You know, we're getting the radical northern version. We often hear that we have the radical southern version, the lost cause version. What we're getting now and what we're being banged over the head with is the radical northern version of treason, for example. I mean, now it's commonplace to throw around that Southerners were traitors. Traitors to what? Who are they traitors to? Their states had seceded from the Union, and so by going with your state, you're supporting the place where you live, your people, your kinfolk. Secession actually happened, both de facto and de jure. So they weren't traitors to the United States. They weren't even part of the United States anymore. This was an open-ended question in 1860 and 61, that somehow we seem to think that now these people were traitors, because you have these anti-reconciliationists, these radical northern position advocates saying that it's treason. Also, that somehow Reconstruction was a, quote, unfinished revolution. What kind of revolution? We're talking about a French Revolution here. Something that is much more radical and dangerous in design. That's what we're looking at in this idea that somehow Reconstruction was a radical event, an unfinished revolution, and an abject failure. It should have gone further. It should have done more destruction, should have done more damage to the Southern political class and those that had actually supported secession at one time or another. It should have gone out and destroyed these people and done away with them entirely. But of course, as these two pieces show this week, that hasn't always been the case. You know, for example, the piece by Gail Jarvis, which was published on Monday the 6th, an inspired narrative, talks about how it used to be not long ago that Southerners thought of things, and Americans in general thought of things in a different way. And what people don't realize is that all of these things, Reconstruction, and then moving forward in several other aspects of American culture, you would have mission creep. What begins as a well-intentioned effort to solve a problem leads to another situation. And so, for example, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was intended to enforce the 15th Amendment, eventually led to mission creep. And now that thing has been extended. For what reason? I'm not certain. A lot of people can't figure out why it's been extended well into 2031, 25 years, so the federal government can oversee Southern elections, because somehow Southerners are preventing people from voting. I haven't seen this. In all the years I've voted in the South, I've never seen one situation in the modern era where Southerners are preventing anyone from voting. In fact, when I go to my polling place, there's not even any voting security in terms of being able to shield your ballot from somebody else seeing it. You're just kind of standing on the wall, marking on the wall. Everybody's milling around together, talking. There's no big deal. People aren't scared to show who they're voting for. There's none of that. No one's in there saying, oh, I hope you don't vote for that person, or you shouldn't vote for that person. And I live in a pretty diverse area. It's racially diverse, and people are in there kind of milling around together. Nobody cares. But yet somehow we need the Voting Rights Act extended out till 2031. This just doesn't make any sense. And of course, all the mission creep came, now it's morphed into what's called social justice, or this political correctness. When there's no other battles to fight because all that's done, now you get the other part of it, which is tearing down Confederate monuments and again, another form of a radical shift in America. This is where the northern version, the extreme northern version, has taken hold because of mission creep. And I think Gail did a nice job explaining that in that piece. But then you also have Philip Lee's piece, which we published on the 8th, on Wednesday, where he talks about the real motivation of Republicans, which was not to lift them up to create well adapted citizens in American society. What they wanted were votes. Grant had said as much. Thaddeus Stevens had said as much. These people were very open about the fact that what they wanted from the former slaves was the ascendancy and the perpetual dominance of the Republican Party. Now, it used to be people talked about that, but you can't say that anymore because nowadays the historic profession, as Philip Lee points out, is dominated by people like the Marxist Sean Valence, who says, quote, "The evidence clearly shows that Grant created the most auspicious record on racial equality and civil rights of any president from Lincoln to Lyndon B. Johnson." Really? That's interesting. Grant said, openly said, he really didn't care about black people. All he wanted to do was make sure they voted for him. Similarly, in 2017, Ron Chernow opined, quote, "Grant's pursuit of justice for Southern blacks was at times imperfect, but his noble desire to protect them never wavered." And then in 2012, H.W. Brands wrote, quote, "Nearly a century would pass before the country had another president who took civil rights as seriously as Grant did." It's amazing how Grant's reputation is being resurrected, again, by this radical Northern version of the war. Grant was interested in the rights of black Southerners, to a point, as long as they voted for him. But as you know, other people have said, but look, if people were really interested in the North and the plight of black Southerners and what was happening to them, why didn't they just relocate them? There's all this territory out west. You could have just gone out there and relocated them. If they were really interested in racial minorities, as Philip Lee points out, why didn't they worry about what was happening to the Chinese in California? Why? Because the Chinese didn't matter. Because they weren't going to win any elections for the Republicans. And so Lee concludes, the lost cause interpretation of Civil War history has been replaced by an erroneous righteous cause mythology that defines the Civil War as a conflict between Northern angels and Southern demons. It has taken a wrecking ball to free speech as well as century-old statues. Yet it was the speech-tolerant demons of the 1960s and beyond who gave the academic angels podiums which make their case, guided by the tenet that if a lie is repeated often enough, it erroneously becomes accepted as the truth. Too many of today's angels demand censorship to viewpoints contrary to their own. They're like the salt of the earth. Nothing grows where they've been. I mean, that's a wonderful conclusion because this is exactly what's happening. During the 1960s, the very conservative old order said, all right, yeah, well, let's hear what you make your case. Let's discuss. And now what's happening is these people will not allow any type of dissent within the halls of the academy. It's just not going to happen. You can't do it. It's illegal. As David Blight said in the New York Times, or the Washington Post, actually, we need to ensure that we essentially shout down those who are saying things that simply aren't true. According to who? The gatekeepers of truth, which is people like David Blight or Eric Foner. I remember when I was in graduate school, I had a professor, and it wasn't Clyde Wilson, but another establishment. He was actually an establishment professor. He was suspicious of Foner, and he tried to maneuver people around Foner because he understood what Foner was doing, which was creating a climate where there was no dissent. If you opposed Foner or his sycophants, you weren't going to get your articles published in any journals. You weren't going to have any voice. So he was trying to maneuver people around that, and that was noble of him because he understood what the Fonerites were doing to American history. They were stifling any type of other type of interpretation. That's dangerous. They are, as we talked about in a piece last week from Kirk Sale, they are essentially conducting a 1984 rewriting of history. And you can't deviate from that. So this narrative of Reconstruction needs to be challenged, and it needs to be challenged well. And I think we're doing a pretty good job of it on the website. But it's more important in many ways to challenge the interpretation of Reconstruction than it is the war, because Reconstruction is where the rubber hits the road after the war is over, and Southerners recognize what was going on. The extreme Northern position was winning out, and they wanted to fight back against that, and so they started telling their side of the story. Now, that's considered to be lost cause, but again, that's the extreme Northern position speaking. So we need to call the North out for what it is, the deep North and the extreme Northern position. We need to talk about Northern studies. What are these people doing that's odd? this position of the South is committing treason. That's an odd position. Nobody at the time really thought of it that way. You did have people saying Southerners were traitors, and they were, and you had conversations this in the North, and eventually I'll have a book review up for that on the website when there's a book that gets into that issue, treason in the war, and diving into that. It's a relatively recent book, but the majority of Americans didn't think that way, North or South. They didn't think that way, which is why the treason argument fell apart for a century or more, and it's only been revived by these people that believe in the extreme northern position of the war. Okay, so those are two interesting pieces. On Tuesday, we ran a little book review, another Shotwell Press book, Randall Ivey's A New England Romance and Other Southern Stories. It's a great little book, came out 2016. Randy Ivey is one of our scholars. He is one of our great reviewers for our website. He does nice literature. We've published a lot of his short stories on the website. He does a very good job with Southern literature, and I like this review. It's written by Patricia Woods, who is a journalist. But she likes the book, and I think it's interesting because what he's doing is speaking of culture. And she says this, quote, "Mr. Ivey has managed to remind us of all the manners and mores of bygone days while presenting the settings of the present, and then he stands back to allow us to witness the upheaval of the inevitable clash." It's essentially, that's a nice way of putting what we're dealing with in the culture war in America right now. It's not so much that we're with the manners and mores of bygone days. It's tradition. And the clash comes because people have forgotten tradition. I used to tell people when they asked me, what's your political, ideology? I would say, well, I'm an American traditionalist. I believe in these things. I'm not a conservative. I'm not a liberal, I'm not a libertarian, whatever you want, whatever label. I believe in American tradition. I believe in tradition. Tradition is good. I believe in Chesterton's fence. I believe that there are certain things that are there and they're there for a reason. And so when you look at manners and mores and customs and these type of things, like some customs are bad, certainly. And you say, well, that's a bad custom, and maybe you change it, you create your own custom. But the fact is, many things, particularly in Western civilization, had been established over centuries by people trying to ward off the dangers in society. And a lot of those dangers were women abusing men and men abusing women and how we interacted with each other and men abusing men and women abusing women. And it's all about interaction and how society interacts with each other. She also says in this review, there were countless scenes that caused me to laugh endlessly. How in the world, I often thought, did he know some of the same kinds of people I have known? I recognize the kindness and the shenanigans of my own kin, as well as some of the people I've met. You probably know them as well because people are pretty much the same everywhere, except the South appears to have a higher share of interesting and, shall we say, eccentric folk, all to the good, as Ivey shows us, and that's true. This is fantastic analysis of, when you look at, this is why Randy Ivey is in many ways the continuation of the Southern literary tradition. People like Flannery O'Connor, I think he does a really good job of that. He had a great, kind of gothic, scary story that we published one time. It was so good. Edgar Allan Poe. And I think it's because he understands people. A story is nothing without the people. It's nothing without the character that makes it feel more authentic. And so I love that about these particular stories and what he's done. And you go to our website and just do a search for Randall Ivey, and it comes up with all of his short stories. And they're really good. And this is something, that the Southerners have done well. We've written good stories, and we tell good stories, and of course, good jokes. And that part of it makes Southern culture unique and interesting. And so I think that's something that I'd love about the Shotwell Press. Isn't just doing, history or political thought. They're also doing literature. That's wonderful because it's an important component of Western civilization. And just go out and support Shotwell Press. Go out and buy their books. There's a lot of good stuff out there from people that wouldn't get published somewhere else. So I'd like that, Mr. Ivey has gotten his due acclaim here in this particular book review, and that you should go out and buy that book. The other two pieces for the week are a little different. One was written by Jonathan Harris, who had a wonderful piece last week on Protestantism in the South and this division of the church and how that helped produce the conflict led to the war. This particular story is of Jewish Confederates. Now, we've done some other articles on Jewish Confederates. The thing I like about this piece is that he gives you a reading, a suggested reading on Jewish Confederates, and then also it's well annotated, so you can go back and check his notes. But what he shows, of course, is that the South was more tolerant of Jewish people than what you might imagine. And that, in fact, it might have been more tolerant of Jewish people than in the North. I think you could almost say conclusively it was. There are Jewish Confederate cemeteries. There are monuments to Jewish Confederates all throughout the South. Judah P. Benjamin, one of the most prominent members of the Confederate cabinet, was Jewish. David U. Lee in Florida was Jewish. You had a number of Jewish Southerners who ardently supported the war and secession. And that's an often overlooked part of the Confederacy. The other thing, of course, is that the Confederacy was extremely tolerant of the five civilized tribes in the Oklahoma Territory, the Indian Territory, and actually gave them a non-voting seat in the Confederate Congress, something they didn't have in the U.S. Congress. And so you actually had Confederate Cherokee, and so you had these American Indian tribes of supporting the Confederacy. So the view of the South as being fairly monolithic is just not accurate. I think in so many ways the South was a much more diverse place than the North. You did have larger numbers of immigrants coming into the North, but when you look at the real diversity and cultural diversity in the South, you had a lot of it on a daily basis. And so a nice article about Jewish Confederates was much needed, particularly since it's often portrayed as people that support the South or that fly Confederate flags are somehow anti-Semitic. That would be news to the Jewish Confederates that flew the Confederate flag and fought under it. The Confederate flag is not anti-Semitic. In fact, you could say it's pro-Jewish in a lot of ways. I mean, it's because Jewish people fought under that flag. And it's preposterous to say that, the South was anti-Semitic. I mean, saying the Southerners are Nazis in the war is a stupid argument. Even if you look at the entirety of the conflict and look at who was supporting the South, large enclaves of Jewish Confederates. It's not anti-Semitic. It's not in any way. It doesn't in any way resemble Nazism or National Socialism. It's just not there. But this is a tactic of the left. This is, again, their deceitful tactics, the extreme northern position type of tactics. As Lee pointed out, the righteous cause, righteous mythology, that just doesn't fit with the actual narrative of the war and the actual events of the war. So it's important to get all of this stuff out there, Jewish Confederates and American Indian Confederates and these type of things, and explain the diversity of the South and the diversity of thought in the South. It was a very tolerant place, in fact. I think in some ways much more tolerant than the North. And then the last piece of the week is kind of an interesting, just something different. The title is A Little Change in the Weather by John Moorcourt, and he talks about weather in the South. And again, this is kind of a contemporary commentary, but it's based on our understanding of the South in terms of weather. And we tend to think, and this is kind of the ahistorical approach. It's interesting. Americans are so concerned about history. As a friend of mine said, here we are 150 years later and the war is still the most important thing in America. But we're so concerned about history, but yet we have historical amnesia with a number of things. And one of those things is the weather. You walk outside and you think, gosh, it's never been hotter than it is right now. Or a storm comes through and it's bad and you think, gosh, that's the worst storm you've ever had. Because we forget. We have historical amnesia when it comes to weather. We forget that the South is a very violent place when it comes to weather. We've had a couple of terrible hurricanes this year in the South. Terrible storms. Did a lot of damage. But we've had that before. One of the situations that we're going through now is that people are living in larger and larger cities, and if a hurricane hits a large city now, it's going to do a lot more damage because more and more people live there. But it doesn't mean we didn't have these things. I was reading a book not long ago about the Mississippi River And one of the best chapters in the book was on the tornado that hit Natchez, Mississippi. And it was categorized as either an EF4 or an EF5, you know, current categorization of a tornado. It was awful. And it did a terrible amount of damage. Came right up the river and hit a number of river boats and did some awful damage. But, I mean, again, we've had tornadoes. There was the most famous tornado, I think, in American history that actually saved America. One of them was the tornado that wiped out the British during the War of 1812. When they had sacked Washington, D.C., a tornado rolls through the camp the next day, and the British scatter, and they're out of there. It was a strong tornado, probably an EF4 tornado that went through the British camp, went through the British Army, and... this was in Northern Virginia, essentially, in Washington, D.C. So we've had bad storms before. We've had them all through the South. That's one thing that's indicative of the South, are bad storms. And I think this little piece does a very good job in showing historically some of these really bad storms. For example, the last island hurricane of 1856, which just wiped out part of Louisiana. I mean, just blew it off the map. You had bad hurricanes. You had bad storms. One of the first attempts at settlement for the Spanish in North America at Pensacola in the 16th century was wiped out by a hurricane. So hurricanes happen in the South. Very severe tornadoes and weather that happens in the South. This is something Southerners have been dealing with for a very long time since Southerners have been here. And yet we seem to think today that all of these storms are getting worse and terrible. It's because there's more people around. There's more people to document these things. We have better weather detection devices, and we have more information out there. But the fact is, we've had bad storms for centuries. We've had bad tornadoes and bad hurricanes for centuries. And it's just that people, again, have this historical amnesia. They don't think, it's warm today. When you hear people say, well, I mean, this is a record for what? Since we've been taking temperature for 100 years? You mean to tell me there's never been a period of time we haven't had an 80 degree day in November in the South? I mean, give me a break. Of course it's happened before. It's just that we don't maybe have a record of it, you know, 120 years ago, 120 years of records. We just don't have it, or 100 years of records. We just don't have it. But I'm certain there was an 80 degree day in Alabama, sometime in history. Since we've been taking temperature data, we just don't have it. In fact, it could have been even when we're taking temperature data, we just don't know. It could have been somewhere in Alabama they had it. We just don't have an accurate recording of it. So this idea that somehow, we're facing the most extreme weather we've ever had. I mean, how do we know that? It's not historically accurate or, you know, historically sound to say these things. Or we've been having, you know, severe storms. We never had any storms like this before. Severe flooding. You know, we never had any flooding like this before. And of course, the Hurricane Harvey situation in Houston, Texas was awful. And the flooding was terrible. And awful situation. But to say that, you know, we never had storms like this before. Yeah, we haven't recorded human history that we've actually got with storm data, but it doesn't mean we haven't had storms. It doesn't mean we haven't had many bad hurricanes at the South in one given year. Just several years ago, we had a lot of bad hurricanes hit the South. This stuff happens. You live in the South, you're going to get bumpy weather. And that's just something that a lot of people just can't seem to grasp. So the South, I mean, I remember when I was touring graduate schools and I was going through Georgia, and I went through a spot and I was actually at the Alexander H. Stevens home in Crawfordville, Georgia. I remember the tour guide saying, yeah, we're going to have, you know, good southern weather tonight. We're going to get some severe storms. I remember him saying that. And, this is something that if you're in the South, you deal with on a regular basis during the spring. It's just something that happens annually. You just learn to tolerate it, learn to cope with it. It's not easy. It's not desirable during hurricane season. If you live near the Gulf of Mexico, you learn that you could get a hurricane. It's something that could happen, and so you prepare. But to say that this is the worst ever, it's ahistorical. It doesn't take into account some of the terrible weather situations that have happened in the South. And I think that's an interesting part of Southern history. You know, we try to do several different things on the website, and one of the things we try to do is have something that's a little different here and there. And talking about weather and Southern weather, it was such a dominant part of Southern life because of agriculture. It's something we tend to forget. But it was very important for Southerners for years to understand the weather. Droughts, too much rain, bad storms, these type of things. These were major, major events because so many people were farmers. And so weather was one of the most important things that people could talk about and understand. And we forget that in our modern cosmopolitan, you know, suburban lifestyle or urban lifestyle. We forget how important the weather was just for the livelihoods of people. Now, with severe weather, we get into it, but this is a hallmark of southern tradition, southern history, coping with severe weather, getting through these very hard times, and it always has been. And I think that's a little interesting and fun little part of what we do at the Abbeville Institute, something a little different from the norm. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Until next time, good day.